Word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, the women who unwittingly launched the nuclear age. We'll hear about the little-known history of the girls from Atomic City. Also today, our tech guru explains what the quantum internet is and why it matters. But first, medieval combat has a renaissance. You're listening to sounds from the 2013 Battle of the Nations, an international event held annually since 2009, this year in the medieval walled city of Aigues-Mortes in the south of France. About 500 men from 22 countries competed in what is part historic reenactment and part full contact sport. Wearing complete medieval armor and using blunted period weaponry, participants hack and slash and wrestle opponents to the ground in groups or in single combat. Jay Brooks is executive officer for the Armored Combat League and Team USA. He competed in the 2013 Battle of the Nations in Aigues-Mortes, France.
There are three specific events that are world competitions. You have your one-on-one, which is, you know, one man versus another man, called triathlon. Mm-hmm. And you fight long sword, sword and buckler, and then sword and shield, back-to-back-to-back, rounds-based, count-based, very similar to boxing. You have five-on-five competition, which is kind of the premier event, and the best five-man teams from each country compete for, once again, the gold medal to see which country has the best five-on-five team. Russia won first place with a five-on-five team, second place with a five-on-five team, third place with a five-on-five team. And then the United States came in fourth.
Mm-hmm. So how long do these rounds last?
Well, the singles rounds last a minute and a half. So you fight steady for a full minute and a half, 1 minute break between rounds.
And that's intense. You have to be pretty fit to do that, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Fitness is a priority with us. The way it begins is you fight in a pool. So you have fighters from multiple countries in your pool. Mm-hmm. The one with the best record will advance to the final 16.
So you've brought some fantastic-looking weaponry. We've got it laid out here. We have photographs at wordofmouthradio.org if anyone would like to see. But I see here a sort of metal gauntlet, a big axe, a sword, a helmet, a full-on helmet. Now, are these recreated to specifications that were used during the medieval era?
These are made with attention to the historical analogs, so that we're trying to make sure that the armor that we're wearing is armor that would be worn together.
Mm-hmm.
So if you went and you looked at an icon, an effigy, went into a museum, you'd find all these items together with one display.
Mm-hmm.
You're portraying a particular knight.
You're actually called Sir Jay Brooks when you compete.
I am Sir Jay Brooks. In the United States, you're knighted after you've participated in Battle of the Nations and fought for your country.
Huh. So these swords, axes, etc., are blunted, however.
They are blunted. Believe it or not, we have a lot of safety in mind.
This axe is really heavy, actually. That's a lot to be swinging around.
It is, but armor is really good. Because we wear authentic armor, you know, when you hit someone in the head with an axe, their helmet actually takes the impact.
I actually see that you have a lot of scratches on this helmet.
There are some scratches and dents on my helmet. But I was hit with halberds, I was hit with swords, I was hit with axes and shield punching and kicking, and I don't have a wound on me.
Wow. So how important is the whole historic accuracy? I mean, I would imagine, as you said, you were a gamer. Maybe you saw these kind of battles as a gamer. How accurately do they represent how the knights used to fight?
Well, the rule set that we're using for Battle of the Nations is more or less based on two particular medieval rule tournaments. One is the Book of King René, which is a treatise on how to perform a tournament, and Le Jeu de Hache, which is another one.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the rules from those and basically smushed them together a little bit to create as accurate a medieval tournament as they could in this modern age.
Is there a referee? Do you get fouls or, you know, yellow cards?
Absolutely. There are marshals watching things. There are judges watching things. And if you do a rules infraction, very similar to soccer, there's yellow cards and red cards. And if you don't listen to the marshals and you break the rules, you get yellow cards or you get ejected from the tournament.
I imagine people do get hurt, though, as productive as the armor is.
Well, just like any fully physical sport, people can get hurt. The United States is lucky we didn't have anyone taken off to a hospital or anything. We had a torn ACL, mm-hmm. which, you know, can happen in any sport. You know, some bangs and bruises, but we did very well.
And you say the cost, like you showed me the gauntlets earlier. This is $1,000 just to manufacture these gloves.
Yeah, these gauntlets are $1,000 for the gauntlets, about $1,500 for the helmet. This leg armor would probably cost about $800.
And when you have it all on, how much does it weigh?
Well, I'm one of the lucky ones. I have a very light suit of armor, so I wear about 41 pounds worth of armor.
Mm-hmm. So you made it very far in this competition, obviously, representing the United States, specifically in the one-on-one category, you did really well. So could you break down your matches for us a little, you know, give us a sense of how it felt to be fighting in full armor?
Well, my opening fight was against a French knight. And seeing that we were in France, I thought it was apropos. Very strong, real physical, bit bigger than me. A little bit of wrestling involved, mostly a lot of cutting. I managed to sidestep him, maneuver him to the edge of the list, and push him out, which got me some extra points. Hit him a lot when it was over. You know, we congratulate each other, and it's all in good spirits.
Mm. Well, obviously you don't, you know, puncture someone's heart afterwards. What is considered winning when someone falls or dead?
Well, it's based on points, like boxing. Uh-huh. So we don't do any thrusting, so there's no stabbing. So puncturing the heart is...
Doesn't happen.
Doesn't happen, thankfully. But every time you strike an opponent with a solid blow, the judges will count it. And just like any martial arts tournament. And if you have the one with the most hits, you know, wins.
So obviously there are a lot of popular culture tie-ins. We have our images and impressions. Everybody knows the lines from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And now Game of Thrones, I think, has kind of thrust this, if not exactly historically accurate, but this era back into our consciousness. Are you guys willing to joke around about this stuff?
Oh, we joke around about that
you
stuff
do,
all
you,
the time.
You taunt each other a second time and that kind
we,
of thing.
We did quite a bit of the... French knight stuff from Monty Python while we were in Aigues-Mortes.
So when you watch films now, like, let's say, Braveheart or Gladiator now, do you look at them differently? Do you watch the fights in a different way?
I have always watched those fights in a different light. And some of the movies we look at and go, they have great choreography. Mm-hmm. And some of them we look at and go, well, that wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm. You're a professional. You have a day job, right? How do you kind of get your head on for this kind of thing?
It's kind of you got to switch it on, switch it off. So luckily I've been doing this a long time. So, you know, when it's time for work, it's time for work. And then when it's time for play, it's time for play. I take this very seriously. So once I leave the office and I go to the hall to train, you know, it's all about training.
I would ask you about how your family feels about this, but now I know that your son is also really full on.
Yes. Well, I met my wife at a medieval tournament in Buffalo, New York in 1985, and we've been together since. And then my son grew up around this medievalism, full contact fighting here in the United States, you know, the way we do our reenactment. And then when we found this, I got involved with this last year. And then my son said, hey, I want to do that too.
You've only been doing this a year.
Yeah, this particular sport, uh-huh. Yes.
I'm wondering, Jay, this kind of combat has become really popular internationally. It's something you're doing, a growing number of people are doing. I've heard of jousting coming back. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about this period that people want to evoke? What is it that you're doing when you're fighting?
Well, I think it's a bit of the romantic, a bit of the thought of the time of chivalry and honor. You know, and as we grew up, we read a lot of Victorian-era interpretations of what the Middle Ages were like. And it kind of hits home when we look at a lot of the problems in the world, some of the moral issues that the world faces. And when we look at this, this seems to be a much simpler time, much more direct, much more honor-driven, you know, knightly virtues and all of that.
Well, it's Sir Jay Brooks. Don't get hurt out there.
Thank you.
You don't frighten us, English pig dogs. Go and boil your bottom, sons of a silly person. You and all your silly English kniggets.
We do have pictures and videos from this year's Battle of the Nations at wordofmouthradio.org, as well as proof that it was pretty much a serious geek out for me. I handled some of the weapons myself. You can also find pictures of those at wordofmouthradio.org or on our Facebook page. Fighting nights were certainly brutal, but we turn now to an even grislier chapter of human history, with a warning that this segment does contain content that could offend sensitive listeners. Archaeologists recently produced the first scientifically verified case of survival cannibalism in colonial America. The discovery of the 17th century remains of a 14-year-old girl shed new light on the deadly winter of 1609 to 1610, referred to by the colonists as the Starving Time. Chief Archaeologist William Kelso from the Jamestown Recovery Project at Preservation, Virginia, worked alongside with the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History on the finding. Dr. Kelso, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about life at Jamestown circa 1609. How were colonists surviving then?
They were particularly desperate. 300 new colonists had come over that summer without provisions. They were surrounded by the Powhatan Indians, Virginia Indians, so they couldn't go out to forage and hunt. And times got extremely desperate and hopeless as they went through the winter and started into the early spring. And one account says that only 60 remained alive out of about 300.
So what is it about this discovery, this skull, that points to cannibalism?
Well, we found a partial skull and part of a tibia, or the shin bone.
Mm-hmm.
And these marks are definite signs of defleshing the head, cracking open the skull, and saw cuts along the jaw. So the forensic anthropologist at the Smithsonian has no doubt that this is done for the soft tissue. And you put that together with there are at least six written accounts that cannibalism was taking place by a few people during that winter. Plus the fact we found these remains in a buried situation that we know we can date to the same year.
How about the cause of death for this teenage girl? Any indication that she was dead and then cannibalized?
There is some indication that she had already died. There are cuts to the forehead that are very close together and very parallel. It was very tentative sort of cuts. If the person was alive and moving, that couldn't have been done. So we don't know the cause of death, but we assume that she, in all probability, starved to death first.
So was the possibility of cannibalism in Jamestown considered before this academically? I know you said there were written accounts, but those could be hearsay. How have academics treated this in the past?
Well, some historians believed it. I'm a historian background as an archaeologist. Mm-hmm. I didn't. I thought the different accounts were so kind of scrambled. They didn't quite jibe. They didn't quite go together. I thought maybe they were written to send back to the sponsoring company saying, hey, we need more provisions. We need more supplies. I didn't really believe it. And maybe I didn't want to, but I have to be objective. And now, I mean, beyond reasonable doubt, we've got these three bodies of evidence, you know, the archaeological context, we've got the written word, and we have the forensic analysis.
So, Dr. Kelso, how did the colonists survive after this starving time, after this desperate winter of 1609 to 1610?
Well, in June, the company sent a resident governor, hundreds more colonists, healthy colonists, and provisions for a year. So they were rescued at the last minute. In fact, they had actually started to leave Jamestown on ships, and they were intercepted after about 6 miles down the river. So then after that, it's not a story of happily ever after for the colony. They had other hard times, but it never went to this low point again.
Dr. William Kelso is chief archaeologist with the Jamestown Rediscovery Project at Preservation, Virginia. There is a video with more on the find at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, what the heck is a quantum internet and why should we care? Stay with us and find out the answer. That's when Word of Mouth continues. A government lab recently announced that it's been operating something called a quantum internet at a Los Alamos laboratory for the past 2 years, which got us wondering, what on earth is a quantum internet? Rob Fleischman is chief technology officer at Zerocol, and he's the guy we call when we want to understand strange new technologies. Rob started with a quick primer on the regular old internet that we all know and love.
The internet you have today runs on electricity. So you have ones and zeros flowing down cables. Sometimes those cables are fiber optic cables using light. But what we're talking about here is using photons or elementary particles. And that's some pretty nerdy physics stuff. But the motivation here, what Los Alamos Labs is looking at, is really on the security side. I'll take a break and give you just a 2-second physics explanation. And I'm not a physicist, so
okay,
bear with me.
I'll just buzz if I don't understand anything.
Well, when you start talking about elementary particles, there's something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And what Heisenberg said is, he said, the more precisely the position of something is measured, the less precisely its momentum is known. And that's pretty confusing stuff, but it basically comes down to the observer effect, which is, if you measure something, if you look at something, then you've actually changed that thing. And I'll give you a very simple example. Let's say you go out to your car and you want to measure the tire pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So you put a little tire pressure gauge on your car and it comes back. It says, oh, it's 30 pounds per square inch. Well, actually, using that gauge lets out a little bit of air, right?
Right.
So actually measuring the tire pressure changed the tire pressure by a very small amount, amount that doesn't matter to you or your car, but it did change it. So actually observing the amount of pressure in your tire changed the amount of pressure in your tire. And that's true for everything. Thermometers, you know, they take heat from the room to measure what the temperature is. So mm-hmm. even they change the room's temperature very, very slightly. So none of that matters very much in the real world. But when you start talking about tiny particles, measuring them changes it. So what's interesting and what Los Alamos Labs is doing is they're saying, well, if we build an internet, if we build a communications channel using photons and things that change when you measure them, think about the security implications of that. If I send you a message, Virginia, and someone along the line, someone between us reads that message, you'll notice it.
That changes the message.
That changes the message. And that's not true with electricity. It's not true with the internet we have today, but with what Los Alamos Labs is playing with is they're playing with a way to generate a communication channel that the receiver of the information can see whether someone in between us has even read it, has even accessed it. That's unique and powerful from a security and cryptographic view. Most people don't understand that, you know, when you're communicating with your bank over the internet, that flies through dozens, hundreds of machines. You know, the data is relayed and retransmitted many, many times. Now, there's a lot of cryptography and technology to try and keep that secure, but Los Alamos Labs is really pushing the envelope, trying to say, how can we get to that ultimate level, the ultimate level where that channel is completely secure, way down, you know, to the photon level, to the particle level.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand, will there be any kind of perceptible difference for us, the end user, or for, you know, businesses who are setting up quantum internet? And how far away in the future is this?
Well, right now, Los Alamos is really at the experimentation stage. They're working on devices that can do this. And to make this really viable in the real world, you need things like routers and gateways. And I mean, there's a lot of technology that needs to build. They're really doing the fundamental research. You know, I mean, if I were to guess, I would say that this is really useful in extremely secure networks, perhaps military, highly secure financial transactions, maybe interbank transfer types of usage. And I believe that, you know, this kind of technology will certainly be deployed in the next 10 years, you know, for those really, really critical infrastructure needs that security is the number one and price doesn't matter.
Rob Fleischman, Chief Technology Officer at Zerocol, and the guy we call to help us understand things like quantum technology. Rob, thank you so much.
Always great to be here, Virginia.
You'll find links to more on the quantum internet at wordofmouthradio.org. At 11:59 on April 30th of 2012, Paul Miller, a writer and reporter for The Verge, unplugged his Wi-Fi and Ethernet cables and traded in his smartphone for 1 year without the internet.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Paul's off the internet, dude.
Paul is leaving the internet for a year. You've been on the internet for a super long time. You're most of your adult life.
Right.
And you want to write, he wants to write about, like, what his life is like without the internet.
It's something that I want to do for the personal exploration of how it would help me deal with my productivity, my creativity, and figuring out how the internet's impacting me.
And just stop and smell the flowers.
Paul Miller joins us now via Skype from New York City to tell us how it worked. Paul, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about those first few weeks. Did you have any withdrawal symptoms? Did you stop and smell the flowers?
I had no withdrawal. It was no detox. I was just having a wonderful time. I was euphoric, really. I really was. And I did stop and smell the flowers, and I was doing all sorts of awesome outdoor activities, and I was very productive, and it was a really wonderful start, for sure.
Well, I understand that you also lost 15 pounds.
Well, I've lost 15 pounds, like, in the first 3 months, and then I've lost, like, another 10 or 15 after that.
So are we going to expect the Internet-Free Diet book to come out by Paul Miller?
You know what? I should write that just to make a lot of money. And then I can do whatever I want.
You're a writer from a major technology site, which paid you, by the way, to do this. How did it feel to be behind the curve as far as, you know, all of the things that people were talking about?
I don't know. It sucked at first. And there were times when my coworkers kind of made it clear to me, like, Paul, you are not really that useful to us as a as a technology pundit right now. But at the same time, it was kind of nice being a little out of the flow, you know, like a little behind the times, or not behind the times, but just I was coming from left field. I was like, you know, I was a different perspective on what mattered. And that was fun. I don't want to do that my whole life. I don't think anybody would tolerate me being that for my whole life, but it was fun to do that for a while.
I don't even know how we could have booked you for this segment without email access. How did you communicate with people?
Well, I had a P.O. box, so I'd get letters, and then I wouldn't reply to the letters. And so since I didn't reply to the letters, someone would try to reach out to a coworker who would hopefully get a hold of me. You know, the people who could get a hold of me were people who had my phone number. And so it was a pretty small circle. And in fact, that circle kind of shrank a little. A friend of mine moved to China. He never gave me an address or a phone number. And, you know, so I didn't stay in sync with people very well. And so, you know, at first I did have a lot of fun, but if I didn't expend a lot of energy keeping in touch with everybody, I would just not be in touch with people. And that started to be pretty bad.
Yeah, you write about this kind of loneliness. But at the same time, at the beginning, you sounded like you really did want to pull away from the fray. So did you benefit from that in anywhere? You know, did you feel more self-reliant or more self-motivated, you know?
Yeah, at first I did feel more self-reliant and self-motivated. And there is something to loneliness and to thinking deeply to do good work. But there also it also just became too much. It became too much disconnection, and it was really unhealthy. And I became less productive because, you know, I was out of it.
Yeah. What's it like to be back online after a year off for you?
It's really overwhelming. I was trying to describe it to somebody. It's like if you get told that you're going to be like a NASCAR driver now, and then the next day you show up and they put you in a car and you're driving. And it's just like, it's so insane. And it's kind of difficult for me to use the internet. I'm almost panicking, really, trying to figure out how to use this contraption again.
It was an experiment designed to help you better understand yourself. Was it successful? Do you understand yourself better?
I thought I'd be a better person without the internet, or a more real person. But what I realized is that this is me, this is who I am, with or without the internet, and I'm glad to be back.
Well, we're glad to have you back. Paul Miller, writer and reporter for The Verge, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The third annual Alton Weagle Unusual Ascent Day took place this past Monday on Mount Washington. The event is not unlike its rather quirky name. This year, a fresh patch of late May snowfall shut down the summit, But participants still gathered at the base of the auto road and walked, ran, paddled, and rolled as far up the mountain as they were allowed in the unusual fashion of their choosing. NHPR's Sean Hurley took a radio field trip to the spectacle.
75-year-old Otak Benhoir stares at the white powder top of Mount Washington. He's about to go rolling along the auto road in a shambling contraption of five inner tubes.
You know, this is my 50th anniversary as Mr. Inner Tube.
Why are you Mr. Inner Tube?
I'm going to show you.
Okay.
We went down the Housatonic River and in a giant slalom, and somehow I ended up being Mr. Inner Tube. I just came back from Hollywood dancing with Jerry Lewis. And so I was dancing with Jerry Lewis all over the place, just playing games.
And the next thing he knew, he'd been proclaimed Mr. Inner Tube, 1963. 50 years later, Otak Benhoir marks the occasion with a dizzying roll on the mountain road.
Whoa.
Not far away, in a top hat and with a stuffed dove peeking from between the buttons of his shirt, Hans Bauer ascends in a pair of construction stilts mounted with 15-foot-high flagpoles that keep catching on the overhanging branches.
A gorgeous Memorial Day weekend. Happy to be here in the spirit of Alton Weigel, enjoying a whimsical day on this first of summer. The flags are flying, and it couldn't be better.
Last year, Bauer went up backwards, blindfolded, skipping rope in lederhosen, very much in keeping with the spirit of Alton Weigel himself, who in the 1950s engaged in a series of publicity stunts, as Mount Washington media director Steve Camming terms them.
I'm going to say he was maybe a prototype of an environmentalist, promoter, man of the mountain. He loved these mountains, certainly, and I think he wanted to get the message of their worth and their beauty out into a broader audience.
Weigel hiked and ran the mountain backwards, barefoot, blindfolded, pushing wheelbarrows with 100 pounds of sugar. Last year, North Conway fireman Jesse Lyman hauled up 75 pounds of firefighting equipment. This year, Lyman, who's also a sixth grade teacher, is dressed up as the Cookie Monster. Three of his students, Jack Sampo, Sam Green, and Grace Sisler, are disguised as chocolate chip cookies, who, for some Alton Weigley reason, also kick soccer balls.
Well, we were talking Teletubbies, right?
Yeah, but they were really expensive.
But they were like, yeah, to get costumes and do that, a little more. Plus, I didn't want to be baby Teletubby or whatever that was, right?
The road is thick with snow and ice at the 4-mile mark and not safe. Only the anonymous patriot has been cleared for the summit.
My office is at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. And Martin Luther King said, go to the highest mountain in New Hampshire and let freedom ring. And that's how I respond to terrorism.
Speaking from behind a Guy Fawkes mask and with a replica of the Liberty Bell that he intends to ring at the summit, the patriot is on a different kind of mission.
Anonymous, strong. Woo!
Doing something hard while doing something silly is a cosmic and comic business.
Determination. When you want to do something, you do it. You make it a little sick, but you just keep going. And that's what I'm doing. Keep on going.
Mr. Inner Tube, 1963, Otak Benhoir, keeps on going. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
You can see a slideshow of photographs from the third annual Alton Weigel Unusual Ascent Day at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, the story you haven't likely heard about the birth of the atomic bomb. We'll hear about the thousands of women who unwittingly helped launch the nuclear age. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
And terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium, and scandium, and cerium, and cesium, and lead, praseodymium, and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonium, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We turn now to the untold story behind a pivotal moment in history. Here is President Harry Truman defending his decision to bomb two Japanese cities in August of 1945.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans.
The development and deployment of the atomic bomb is generally told as a narrative driven by powerful men like Oppenheimer, Truman, and Stimson operating at the highest levels of government. What few people know is how many women played a crucial role, albeit unknowingly, in one of the most significant turning points in history. Denise Kiernan interviewed several women who worked in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, a secret government-built town created as part of the Manhattan Project. Their stories, combined with detailed reporting, come together in a new book called The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. And Denise Kiernan, we welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on.
The town of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, did not appear on any maps in the U.S. Tell us a little bit about how it was built and what these women were doing there.
The town of Oak Ridge was actually purpose-built. Some people think it was repurposed for the war, but actually it did not exist before late 1942 when they broke ground and did not appear on any maps until 1949. The government went in, and really between late 1942 and mid-1945, took what was really a very sparsely populated area in East Tennessee and turned it into a town of 75,000 residents, using more electricity than New York City, operating one of the country's largest bus systems, and many of those residents were, in fact, young women.
They came from all over the U.S., some from right there, like Toni Peters, one of the women you spoke to. Her family's farm was seized to make way for the town. Others got on buses in New York City and Texas and Alabama to come there, many leaving home for the first time. Denise, what kind of jobs were they doing?
That varied widely, much as it did throughout the war. As we know, World War II was a moment of increased opportunity in the workplace for women across the United States. For the Manhattan Project, because Oak Ridge was itself a functioning town, there were secretarial jobs, there were jobs in the cafeteria, and there were jobs, of course, in the plants that were working to enrich uranium for the bomb. Some people, like Colleen, one of the women I feature, she inspected pipes all day. Now, she didn't know where these pipes were going, and she didn't know what was going to be going through them or what purpose they served, but she was trained very specifically to inspect pipes. Toni, the young lady you mentioned earlier, she worked as a secretary. She worked filing all day. And even though she was actually in the headquarters building, she still did not have any idea what the project was about. Other women, scientists, might have analyzed compounds in a lab. Other women worked operating machines that were actually helping separate isotopes of uranium, but of course they did not know that. So the jobs available to them really did vary greatly, some of them Manhattan Project specific, and others just the kinds of jobs you would find in any town.
Without any information about what they were actually doing, rumors swirled. And there were a couple that you write about, you know, one that people who were hired to empty the garbage were illiterate. And there were public information officers deliberately fueling some of them. Now, this was a town of 75,000 surrounded by fencing and watchtowers and guards. I mean, how did this affect them? How did they talk about that experience of living in a place that sort of looks like prison?
Certainly, it was unnerving on a certain level. But then what most of the women said and the men I interviewed is you just started getting used to it. It was, you know, you went through the gate and wore a badge to get where you needed to go. And, you know, at first when you arrived, that was a little shocking and unnerving. But then after a while, it was just kind of normal. A lot of what got them through, I will say, is that the one thing they were not told a lot, but the one thing that they were told was that this was an important project for the war. And pretty much everybody I interviewed had a brother or, you know, a boyfriend or somebody who was away fighting. And so at this, in this period of time, I mean, it really was, World War II really was the cause of their generation. And I think they were willing, most of them, to put up with the secrecy, and, you know, for that very reason.
We're talking with the writer Denise Kiernan about the thousands of women who worked entirely unwittingly on the Manhattan Project in a secret government-built town in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's a subject of her book, The Girls of Atomic City. Now, Denise, this is an era of overt sexism and racism in American culture and social structures. Many of these women were given a kind of independence in this experience. You spoke to one, Katie Strickland. She's an African-American who did janitorial services at CEW. That's the Clinton Engineering Works. What was her experience compared to other women?
Well, because segregation was the law of the Oak Ridge Reservation, which was also called the Clinton Engineer Works, for Katie, I felt so privileged to be able to speak with her because, you know, she was sharing a part of her life that in many ways was very difficult and stressful for her. However, the pay that she received was what encouraged her to go ahead and live under these circumstances, as upsetting and angering and frustrating as they were. And I think the most heartbreaking aspect of her existence was the fact that African-American couples married were not allowed to live together, mm-hmm. and they were not allowed to bring their children. So Katie and her husband, Willie, had to leave their children with Katie's mother back in Alabama, and they would send as much money as they could back home whenever it was possible. And it was a very, very trying time for that reason. But at the same time, Katie still lives there today. I mm-hmm. saw her, you know, just a couple weeks ago. So, you know, oddly enough, that place became home to her.
Many, many of the couples did. You keep this secret, referring to the project throughout the book until 1945, when the Undersecretary of War, Robert Patterson, sends a letter to all of those working in Oak Ridge on August 7th, congratulating them on their patriotic duty. The headline in the Oak Ridge Journal after the two bombs were dropped says, "Oak Ridge attacks the Japanese." It's so interesting. They all took this on very sort of personally, but how did they feel? Tens of thousands of people were killed. They were working in secret on something that a lot of people had great ethical qualms about.
It was it's a fascinating part of the book for me. It was fascinating to research and do that particular line of interviewing because for so many people, the realization of what the bomb was came sort of in waves. I mean, I don't know what it's like to live in a world without the atomic bomb. I don't know what it's like to live in a world without the idea of fallout shelters and nuclear winter and somebody who can push a button and, you know, unleash something so incredibly devastating and destructive. These people straddled two worlds, really, and they were around for the dawn of the nuclear age and were a very significant part of it. For some people, the first thing they heard was just, there's a new super bomb. And okay, there's a new super bomb. Then there's the address from the president, and Oak Ridge is mentioned.
Right.
So they know they had something to do with the new super bomb, but specifically, no one was taken aside and said, here's the role that you did. And there was a real mix of feelings. I mean, one woman I spoke to, I think, really kind of captured it best. She said, you know, I was so happy the war was over, but I was so sad when I learned about what happened because, you know, I really like people. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very, very simple and kind of very poignant way to put it. So there were a lot of mixed feelings. No one I talked to was happy about the devastation. Some people felt very sad. And some people were just happy that their brothers or boyfriends or fathers were coming home.
Denise Kiernan, author of The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Woman Who Helped Win World War II. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You will find much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org, including a slideshow of photographs from Oak Ridge from the National Archive. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org.
world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, in so far as possible, the killing of civilians. But that attack is only a warning of things to come. If Japan does not surrender, bombs will have to be dropped on her war industries, and unfortunately, thousands of civilian lives will be lost. I urge Japanese civilians to leave industrial cities
immediately. Listening to Two Dumb Lovers by Tristan Omond. It's off his latest album, Wandering Time.
Try so hard, but can't get back home. Lost somewhere down by Arkansas.
The Manchester-based singer and songwriter tells stories of America's rougher edges, tending towards characters who've been kicked around by life. Their surfaces hardened by booze and women and lives spent on the road, with a few clues of deeply submerged softness.
Day and night she draws her veil, imagining and picturing the nail she would drive through his head, and the picture she hung over the bed.
Tristan came by to play in Studio D and talk about the characters and hard luck stories in his songs.
Once I started going into my solo stuff full force, I just really got into folk music. I started going to the library every day and reading books and checking out CDs and listening to them, like Pete Seeger live at Carnegie Hall. You know, I would just soak it in and just listen and listen. I was just, like, so enamored with the history and with folk music.
With a heart full of questions and old scars on his face. A tap dancing woman still twirls through his mind. And a past with no answers still lingers behind. But in the morning comes the bird song, through the curtain shines a new dawn. So tie up those boots, get a move on.
When I thought of the, you know, the pre-chorus, the when in the morning comes the bird song, through the curtain shines a new dawn, like through those like big heavy rubber curtains that are in the motel or hotel, you know, so tie up those boots and get a move on. It's kind of like, yeah, at the end of the night you're in despair, but in the morning you wake up and the sun comes through the window and there's some sense of rebirth, or like you can try again.
There's a train. I think I hear it. Song of love in the dark. The dawn is coming. Birds are ringing. Bells are singing in the church. The Ford Ranchero and Plymouth Duster can barely muster horsepower up the hill.
You know, I'm not religious or anything, but I just pictured cars climbing up the hill to the church on this day, and it's breezy and everybody looks nice, and then there's this just disheveled, like, you know, shred of a man sitting in the back. Probably the preacher would be like, "You're a sinner." I'm like, you know, probably scorn him or something. And I just imagined that guy, and this is his last night in town, and before he goes to the way of the wind, you know, he's just gonna leave.
When the best of everything you know is how to numb your head, stiff drinks and lipstick, Winston cigarettes, deaf to all the daily things and long for the one short moment in the garden and the sun. Yeah.
Probably most of my tunes are like 15%, you know, reality, and then 85% fiction. You know, it's like I don't want to just get up there and strum a guitar and sing some song about my ex-girlfriend or something like that. There's so many people doing that. Not that I just like tailor my songs for people to listen to. You know, I want them to be interesting for myself to sing.
And I get up in the evening, and I'm drunk to work in the morning. I'm always on time. She lives with me in the house I built, and now I feel like it's burning. I sing on the back porch, I sleep in the barn. I tattooed over her name on my arm, and I've done all the things that I think I should do, but I can't help feeling that it's all 'cause of you.
Somewhere between India and Idaho, I thought up that phrase, and then I said, okay, how can I use that in a song? And I kind of wrote my way to that phrase. And I think it was kind of like I wanted to have some sort of kind of Woody Guthrie type rhythm to it. And then the chorus that I sing on the back porch, I sleep in the barn, tattooed over her name on my arm. You know, I was like, yeah, has the feeling of like, oh, I'm in the doghouse now, I'm singing on the back porch and sleeping in the barn. You know, it's like she kicked me out.
So now I'm going where the streets are gold. It rains cocaine and cherry coke. And there's a beach where the fishes speak Navajo. Somewhere between India and Idaho. Somewhere between India and Idaho.
People that actually tell me, you know, you should think about going on America's Got Talent. Like, you think you could really knock them dead? You know, and I'm just like, no, it's like that goes against my whole personal constitution. You know, it's like I'd rather die penniless than jump ahead in line in front of a bunch of people. You know, like I feel like I'm working it. I'm working as hard as I can. I'm playing a lot of shows, you know, over 100 a year. I'm touring. I just released this album in December. I feel really great about it. I'm going to keep putting that out there, and I have more material, and I want to release another album soon, and I just want to keep touring and playing and writing.
High tension wire haloed up in the air, gray sky above, cold breeze blowing fair. How long this trail goes, I am not so sure, but I'll follow your directions word for word. I got my walking stick and I got my walking boots. I got my thinking hat. I'm a vagrant on the loose. I shall walk with the sunrise heavy on my back. Now I've found there's no turning back. Yeah, how long this trail goes, I am not so sure. But I'll follow your directions word.
Tristan Ament will be playing on June 13th at the Dover Brick House in Dover, New Hampshire. You can see video of his performance live from Studio D at wordofmouthradio.org.
I will wade across rivers and on through the fields.
There's more Word of Mouth online anytime, and you can listen to segments on demand and pass them along to friends at wordofmouthradio.org or on the free NHPR iPhone app. We also invite you to become a part of Word of Mouth's ongoing conversation with listeners. That's on our Facebook page. Or send us a tweet with your ideas and thoughts on Word of Mouth, past, present, or future. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth returns next week with the sounds of more new ideas right here from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Molly Donahue
and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals,
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast
and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.